Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He says the stock market finally saw some price action this week. He also checks out crude, gold, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. The founder of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, gives us his views on whether interest rates will continue to rise, the U.S. debt ceiling, AI mania, gold, and silver. Publisher of WolfStreet.com, Wolf Richter, checks in from San Francisco. He takes a look at U.S. consumer spending, inflation, EVs, and their impact on the crude market, and empty commercial real estate space. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how did the markets finish out the week?
Well, I mean, hey, we finally got some price action here. You got the S&P finally on Thursday manages to get up through the highs of earlier this year, testing the August levels. The Dow didn't manage to do the same type of thing. It's still faltering in the middle of its range, and we know what the Russell's doing. It just keeps playing in the bottom quartile of its trading range in the last 8 or 10 months. But the Nasdaq, as always, has been the strong one, and it's those big half a dozen or maybe 10 stocks that are just pulling it along. The Nasdaq did manage during the week to close at the best level since April of last year. Tail end of the week, though, we got on Thursday some good short-term sell signals there. Probably going to be looking for at least, a 3 or 4 day pullback here. The weekly charts have got bigger signals than the dailies, and could be that we're going to be setting up for a more significant top, I would say, in the next couple of weeks before we get a decent correction.
What's going on with gold?
The gold market this week got hit. Silver had been trending down, and gold did a little bit of a catch-up. Depending upon whether you're looking at the spot price and when your closing time was, on the week it's down anywhere from $32 to $40. Got a little overdone on the downside, and interestingly, this is at about the same time that the U.S. dollar index, which had been doing very, very well, it rallied up over 103, and so as the dollar was rallying, gold and silver were under pressure, and at the tail end of the week, we've got the reversal in the dollar index. The index itself had been, as say, up into the high 103s, closed the week off at 103. It looks as though it's ready for a little bit of a small pullback, and that should give a bounce in the precious metals, but I think we're still a little ways off on looking for a decent low. The seasonal for that one, for gold and silver, basically you're looking out to do July, when we want to start being aggressive on things, so I'm not too interested in pressing the positions right now. I think you'll get a better opportunity. And the commitment of traders numbers for the precious metals had been reasonably high the last 3 or 4 weeks, not quite up into what we would have considered a major sell signal, but high enough to put us into a vulnerable state. So, with with that kind of thing and the way that it lost momentum, I'm not surprised that we're seeing a correction here.
What's happening with crude?
Crude stuck in its trading range here. 74, we mentioned a week ago, is the resistance. It sold off a little bit during the week, midweek, but did manage to close off the week reasonably well in the 72.5 range. It's got a pretty much sits this resistance, as I say, at 74, and I wouldn't be at all still surprised to see that we test that $65 level that it kissed twice, one back in March, and then just, 2 weeks ago now, we got back down there as well. As long as that 74 resistance stays in place, I really think that we've got a chance for some lower lows before the next decent rally as far as the crude is concerned. Now, in the energy complex, the one that was of interest for us was natural gas. We've been talking about the real capitulation that it had back in February when it got down to $2, retested that 2 months later in March, end of March, and again here a couple of weeks ago. This week, got our first decent rally on there, got up into the 275 range. Doesn't seem like a lot when you think about where it was, up to 10, but percentage-wise coming from 2 up to 275 is pretty decent for the traders. And from a seasonal perspective, in the bear markets, and we've taken a look going back into the 1990s and coming forward, in the bear markets, you classically are going to see a rally out of April into a May or June high. If we take a look at the UNG, which is the ETF that is always fighting the forward rates because it deals with futures contracts. So it's not a good long-term investment, but it does provide good trading opportunities. And at this point in that seasonal move, you would expect to see it up and testing its 100-day moving average. The price is currently sitting around 7.5, and this is up from $6 just a week ago. So pretty good move there already. I think you're looking for something in the low 8s as a reasonable target for that one.
Mm-hmm. What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, as I say, the U.S. dollar had a pretty decent rally off the lows. You know, we've come from 101 up to 103.75. Getting, as I say, probably ahead of itself at this point, there's a nice looking base when you take a look at the big picture. The correction that we had from 114 last summer into that first break in February at 103, decent bounce and a test of the lows. Yeah, so. I would suggest that anything is back in the low 102s, maybe 102.25, would be a pretty decent support area for the dollar, and you can be looking for some action on the upside from there. As far as the Canadian dollar is concerned, stuck in a trading range. You know, here we are closing off the week at 74, all it did was got up and tested resistance at 75, and that has really been a lid on the Canadian dollar since November. We've been up there, four times, including November. Just doesn't have the power to get through on the upside. And if the dollar index is going to be strong, as I think, and commodities are going to have a bit of pressure, then you don't want to be looking at the Canadian dollar from the long side at this point.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Martin Straith next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be with you.
Martin, the Fed says it won't cut rates this year, but the markets seem to be saying they will cut rates. If the Fed does cut, will that jumpstart the markets?
Well, that's certainly the common theory, but it's not what history tells us. You know, we have a chart that we show our subscribers, and it highlights that when the Fed's in one of these rate hike cycles, which they're in right now, the bottom in the market typically aligns when the Fed stops cutting rates, not when it stops raising them. And that's a really important point, because typically when the Fed pauses, we see a brief uptick in the markets. But when the Fed starts to cut, that is when the big losses start to happen. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Because the reason that the Fed would start cutting rates is that the economy is in trouble and likely headed for a recession. So investors would then dump the stocks because they know that stocks do not do well in a recession. So markets typically fall as the rates are cut, and not until the Fed stops cutting rates do stocks start to rise again. I'll post this chart that we give out to our subscribers. It'll be in our blog section on our website. So the message for us right here is, if the Fed starts cutting, be careful.
On the flip side, what if the Fed continues to raise rates?
Well, first of all, the stock market would not be pleased. You know, according to the CME FedWatch tool, I just looked at it this morning. The market right now is pricing in an 84% chance that the Fed pauses at their June meeting. So that's only 16% chance that a rate hike would happen. So another increase would not be welcomed by the markets. You know, interesting note too, I was just reading a note from one of the Bank of America strategists, and he's saying that the biggest risk for the tech stocks right now is that the Fed rate rises to 6% before it sees 3%. So that would be another 75 basis point hike, and that would really rattle the markets. So, you know, if we do have a rate hike, that would tell us the Fed is still seeing inflation as a big problem. You know, we've got unemployment in the U.S. is at 3.4%. I mean, that's the lowest since 1969. Plus, you've got U.S. wages are up 4.4% so far this year. So those are not numbers the Fed wants to see. You know, a tight labor market and rising wages, those are both fuel for higher inflation. So we really seem to be heading for stagflation now. And so what that is, that's where you get high inflation, but in a slowing economy. So the Fed's in a tough spot. I mean, if they raise rates, it's going to put pressure on the banking sector. And we saw what happened, you know, the last couple of months. But if they pause or even cut, then inflation may start to rise again.
You were bullish on the U.S. dollar for quite some time, but you said it was overbought back in November. It's dropped dramatically since. What do you see ahead for the greenback?
Yeah, the U.S. dollar was very strong from, early 2021? And that's when the Fed started to aggressively raise rates. And that ran right into September 2022. So over that 22-month period, the U.S. dollar jumped almost 28%. So now, in October, when we called for a top in the U.S. dollar, and since then, it's fallen about 12%. But in the last 7 weeks, the U.S. dollar has been forming a base formation. In the last 2 weeks, it's actually been rising. And it's now broken through the downtrend line from last fall. And it's also breaking through its tight trading range that's been in since mid-March. So to me, it looks like the U.S. dollar is looking like it's getting its legs here. So ultimately, we need to see the U.S. dollar break through the 105 level.
What are your thoughts on the Canuck buck?
Well, the loonie's been trading in a really tight range. So, you know, 75.5 on the high side and 72.5 on the low. So the Canadian dollar is like most currencies, and it trades inverse to the U.S. dollar. So if we see strength in the U.S. dollar, then we see weakness in the Canadian. Also, you know, the Canadian has a strong correlation with the commodity. And given that they are priced in the U.S. dollar, a strong U.S. dollar would hit the commodity prices, and that would then give another blow to the Canadian. So, you know, we're really watching tight trading range. You know, again, key resistance is at 75.5. Well, that key support sits around 72.5 to 73.
Gold and silver have fallen off lately. What do you see ahead for the precious metals?
Well, yeah, gold and silver, you know, they had a terrific couple of runs there recently, you know, from November into late January. And then we had another good run from March into early May. Now, gold actually at the peak there about a couple of weeks ago, it spiked up about 2083. But since then, we've seen gold and silver decline. You know, gold was down about 140 bucks from that intraday high. Now, yesterday it dropped down and it tested just above our target low at 1950. And it's bounced so far today, primarily, I think, because of the debt ceiling talks were breaking down. So people are starting to go a little bit, get a little bit nervous about that. So silver's down over 10% in a little over 2 weeks before today's little bounce. You know, typically in a bull market with the precious metals, we see silver outperforming gold. And then in bear markets, silver underperforms. Now, one of the things that we've been watching closely is that the mining stocks have been lagging the metals. So that's something we're really keeping our eye on. So we're in a pullback here, which gold and silver both needed. So that's healthy. We think gold and silver are going to continue to outperform the S&P 500 for the next couple of years. You know, one of the big drivers, I keep saying this, for gold is going to be the loss of confidence investors have in government. And once that confidence is broken, we expect gold to rise along with the U.S. dollar as a safe haven play. So now, based on seasonality, gold and silver typically have a really good run starting from July right into September. So we would suggest buying the dips here.
Back in mid-March, you were bullish on energy stocks. What is your read on them now?
Yeah, you know, we're very much bullish energy going forward. Back in mid-March, we were telling our subscribers to hold off buying oil or oil stocks because we really saw that oil was going to get down to the below 70, and our target was the low mid-60s. And that's exactly what happened in mid-March. In that time, we added a number of energy stocks. Now, oil then had a really nice run. So it went from that low mid-60s right up to 82.50 in mid-April. But since then, it's been pulling back. And our models are now looking for oil to, again, dip down below the $70 range again and probably into that mid-60s again. You know, there's a ton of unanticipated production from the OPEC plus countries, especially those that are under the Western sanctions. So we're talking here about Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. I mean, simply put, Jim, the black market for oil is booming right now. Also, if we do have a recession, that's going to hit demand, and that's going to push prices even lower. But again, if that happens, it's going to present another really good buying opportunity. Now, if we look back at the bigger picture, longer term, you know, on the demand side, we've got China starting to open up. I mean, it's slower than anticipated, but it's still opening. And then we've got India that's been expanding. And those are two huge markets. I mean, we're talking 2.5 billion people. Now, on the supply side, you know, we continue to see governments imposing windfall taxes, you know, tight regulations, no new drilling. All those are major disincentives for producers. You know, that results in capital expenditures in this sector are down to 35, 40-year lows. You know, and that lack of investment is going to cause a really serious supply problem long term. So long term, we expect oil is going to have a really good next couple of years. We certainly see $100 oil, and potentially we see hitting 150 or even higher in the next few years. Now, in natural gas, now that tends to be very volatile and weather dependent. And of course, we had a much warmer winter than normal, and that's crushed the prices. You know, we saw natural gas prices spike up to, I think it was $9.50 back in August, and it dropped down to $2 just recently. So today it's trading at around $2.60. Now, natural gas tends to have a good seasonal period from March into June, but so far this year we just have not seen that seasonal spike. And there's the main reason, because there's just a ton of supply and weak demand. Now, right now, natural gas is trading around 260. It's been starting to creep up the last couple of weeks. So maybe we hit around the $3 level, but I would doubt we get too much higher than that.
Could commercial mortgage-backed securities be a concern for stock markets and the housing market?
Yeah, they certainly could be. You know, if you look at the stock market, you know, you got to think about investor confidence. So You know, if you have commercial mortgage-backed securities facing some significant defaults or downgrade, well, I mean, that's going to really erode investor confidence in the general market. And then that would lead, you know, increased risk aversion and potential stock market crashes. You know, financial institution exposure, I mean, many of these institutions hold commercial mortgage-backed securities as part of their investment portfolio. So if these values were to decline significantly, then it's going to impact the balance sheet of these outfits. And that's potentially going to trigger, again, another broader market concern. The stock market, you know, it's interconnected, and disruptions in one sector can have ripple effects. So if we were to see commercial mortgage-backed securities related issues creating systemic risk or spillover, that could certainly affect the overall stock market. Now in the housing sector, you've got the whole issue of financial availability. So commercial mortgage-backed securities, they play a crucial role in providing finance for commercial real estate projects. So if these markets experience disruptions or tightening of credit, then it can limit the availability of funds for new projects. And that would impact, you know, commercial real estate projects and potentially residential projects as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if we see a serious problem in the commercial mortgage-backed securities area, it would create fear that we also have a problem in the residential mortgage-backed security sector. And, you know, similar to what we saw back in the 2008 financial crisis. So, yes, you know, I think that if we see problems in commercial-backed securities, it would certainly have a ripple effect in the stock and the housing markets.
Do you see any solution for these vacant office towers in the cores of so many cities now?
Well, it's interesting on that. You know, Calgary, I know, is sort of leading the way where they're converting a lot of their, well, I don't know if it's a lot, but they're certainly converting some office towers into residential. So, I mean, that certainly makes sense. I mean, I don't know, I'm no engineer, so I don't know what the work, I assume some of that's pretty hefty. But, you know, sounds like Calgary's kind of on the leading edge of that.
Yeah, and I also saw a documentary where a developer from India has developed kind of a camper trailer capsule kind of thing that you can insert into office spaces and turn those into living spaces without a lot of extra work. Just take down some of the partitions and so on and park these one and two bedroom capsules in there.
Yeah, there it is, you know, just creativity, right? That's what we need more of, people thinking things through and coming up with solutions. I mean, you and I were talking just before the call about how, you know, there's solutions out there for all kinds of things. There's some very smart people. Technology is just at levels it's never been before. And we just need these kind of ideas, and we need people to put them into place so that, you know, some of these things can actually happen.
And if we're going to have hotter summers and more forest fires, why haven't governments helped the flying tanker companies develop new planes that are like the Martin Mars, which they say is obsolete, but is actually has one of the most advanced avionics suites in the world?
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like, if we're going to invest all these tax dollars into things, let's do those things that actually help the country, help the economy, and so on.
Also, with the push for AI, is this going to be like the high-tech push back in the 80s where they just said if it has the words high-tech, people just poured money into it, but eventually about 90% of them went under?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, if we look at the stock market itself, you know, what have we seen? We've seen big tech, and primarily the eight big tech stocks have accounted for all of the gains in the stock market so far this year. You know, the NASDAQ 100, it's jumped to, you know, all-time highs. You've got Microsoft and Apple. You know, they're now up to 14% of the S&P 500 market cap. And combined, they've added over $1 trillion in value just this year so far. So, I mean, if it wasn't for the AI frenzy, the stock market indices would be down for the year. So it's a very, you know, this whole rally is very distorted, very on a bullish side, because it's driven by such few stocks.
Is AI going to replace us?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask AI that, I guess. Well, it's certainly, I think it could, Jim. I mean, you know, the ability of the machines to learn and adapt is amazing. I mean, I'm sure everybody's now tried the ChatGPT or the Bing's version of the ChatGPT. And it is quite amazing when you, I mean, you can throw a lot of things at it and, you know, you get a response within seconds.
And with that hanging over us, I know the European Union is talking about putting a tax on AI or robots for every person it replaces to help support that person.
Yeah, well, that's always their answer, isn't it? Tax. Like, that seems to be pretty much the only answer they come up with. Unfortunately, by the time that tax money, you know, runs through the bureaucracy of the government and gets out to people that lose their job, I think that, you know, they'll just keep raising more and more taxes.
And, of course, who knows where that computer or server is based, and would they recognize that tax?
Exactly.
Martin, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, I think that, you know, right now, to me, the markets, you know, we got this whole debt ceiling, you know, boondoggle going on. So we need to get through that. But, you know, the whole issue to me of, you know, the recession is still there and it's still big. So I think that for investors, we're still very cautious here. We've got a ton of stocks. We have some great watch lists of stocks that we're watching. But, you know, I think that we're going to have some economic trouble. And I think it's going to be global. And so that's not a good sign. So, you know, we're going to get through it. But I think that people really have to have some good strategies for, you know, how to protect their wealth in times of downturn. You know, our technical trader services, you know, it started as a hedging service. And it's got all kinds of great strategies that are so easy to implement. And it helps protect you. Just like, you know, you buy fire insurance. Well, you certainly hope you don't have to use it. But it's important to have it. So I think that, you know, we're going to have, I think energy is going to be big, just as we talked about earlier. I think gold and silver are going to do very well in the longer term. But there's going to be volatility. There's going to be spikes up and down, and people need to be aware of that.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. And just before we go, maybe explain what the Trend Letter does.
Okay, yeah. Well, we've got the Trend Letter is there's three publications. There's the Trend Letter. So that's been around since 2002, so 22nd year. That comes out. It's a weekly publication. The audience for that is you know, people that are longer-term investors who really want to get an understanding of what drives the markets. And what we do there, it's a lot of charts with some just key bullet points and really helping people to understand why the markets are doing what it's doing and what likely is going to happen in the future. Technical Trader, as I just mentioned, you know, that started as a hedging service, but also it does long positions now. So it covers commodities, equities, precious metals, et cetera. Again, the audience there, for more active investors, but again, long-term investors have done really well by using some of those hedging strategies during the you know, this volatile times we've had. And the third one is trend disruptors. So that's a very speculative area. So now we're talking about disruptive ideas. So you talk about artificial intelligence, virtual reality, you know, 5G, the cloud, Internet of Things. So again, the audience here are those who wish to speculate, but only using capital that they can afford to lose.
Martin, thanks again.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
My guest has been Martin Straith. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to the show, Wolf.
Thanks for having me back.
Wolf, could the constriction of credit or quantitative tightening constrict the economy faster than the continued raising of interest rates?
So, yeah, that's kind of a global surge of inflation after a global surge of money printing. And so now we've got this complex situation where we're raising interest rates, the central banks are raising interest rates, and at the same time have these balance sheets that have all these assets on them that they bought when they went through the money printing binge. And so raising interest rates is the classic method of reducing demand a little bit when companies increase prices. They don't stick. You know, consumers are looking at these higher prices and are not buying. They're switching to competitors and delaying purchases, those kind of things. That's what happens when you make it a little bit more difficult for consumers to borrow money, or when some people lose their jobs. And so you get this decline in demand that will eventually, hopefully, maybe crush inflation. And that is now very difficult, because after all this money printing, you know, this money is still out there. It didn't go away. It's still circulating around there. And so we've got way too much money chasing after too few assets. And yeah, you have the wealth effect where the asset prices went up, and people that got wealthy that way because of money printing, they are now spending this money. And so central banks have started trimming down the balance sheets, but the Bank of Canada has been fairly aggressive with that. And it has gotten rid of half of the money that it printed during the pandemic. And that's a lot. You know, the Fed is just looking at less than 10% right now that it's gotten rid of. And so the Bank of Canada has chosen another route. It's more aggressively working with its balance sheet, but it has raised interest rates less. So it raised its policy rate to 4.5%. The Fed is now at the top end. It's at 5.25%, and we may have another hike coming. The Bank of Canada has said it's pausing. It may still hike again, but we had inflation tick up again in Canada. So, you know, this inflation isn't dead by any means. It just keeps going. So the question is, how can you, crack down on this inflation? And, the classic method of hiking interest rates was kind of the only method they used to have. Now, because balance sheets were never this bloated. You know, central banks had never these kinds of assets on the balance sheets. Now they do. And so now you have this second method of undoing the money printing, of taking the money back in that they printed, you know. And, this can have a pretty serious effect on asset prices. It's just as much as money printing inflated asset prices, taking it away has a deflationary effect on asset prices, which impacts the wealth effect, and people feel less wealthy, and so they spend a little less, and that takes off some of the pressure to spend and on prices. And in addition, you have companies that are now getting squeezed because they're having to pay higher long-term interest rates on their debt. That's a result of quantitative tightening as well. So, we don't know really how this is going to work out, because we've never been in a situation where we had this big bout of inflation and central banks had these big balance sheets. I mean, that's a new combination that we've never had before. So the second tool quantitative tightening now is a new tool against inflation, so we don't really know how well it works. But there are a lot of people that say, that should be done more aggressively. Instead of hiking interest rates much further than where they are, the next leg in that inflation fight should come from the balance sheets. And that makes sense to me. And interest rates are already in the United States, short-term interest rates are above 5%, and in Canada they're at 4.5%. So, that's pretty high for economies that haven't seen those kinds of short-term rates in decades. And, at the same time, long-term rates are low. They're below those short-term rates. Our 10-year treasury yield in the United States is at 3.6%. So if the central bank get rid of their assets, that tends to push up long-term yields more and impact the longer-term securities more. And I think this could have a it could be fairly effective in fighting inflation. And, you know, if you have short-term rates that are high enough, and if the central banks unprint the money that they printed, you know, fairly quickly, I think that would be a fairly effective solution to the inflation problem we now have.
Aren't interest rates inflationary themselves, causing a vicious cycle where inflation rises, then interest rates rise, leading to more inflation, and then more rising interest rates?
So every time there is a movement in monetary policy by central banks, it has more than one effect. It has a bunch of effects, generally. And so when the central banks raise the short-term interest rates, the money that people earn on their savings, on the treasury securities, on the money market funds, you know, they earn more money then. And so now in the United States, we're getting 5% or more on CDs. We're getting 4% on savings accounts. Money market funds are between 4.5% and 5%. Short-term treasuries are nearly all over 5%. And, you know, we're talking, you know, roughly $20 trillion that is now earning 5% interest, when a year and a half ago, they earned essentially zero. And a lot of the people that earn this money are retirees that are spending every dollar that they get. And they were, when interest rates were at zero, you know, they were starving essentially, because their savings didn't earn them any more money and they couldn't spend this money. And that's why after the financial crisis, because people that relied on the yield from the investments, they didn't get that. And that was cut out, you know, and they couldn't spend the money anymore. And then we had a very slow recovery because interest rates were at zero. And there's a big part of the spenders, you know, that weren't making any money on their investments. And so now when we shift this around, we have seen this, you know, and I see it in the comments on my website. I have a lot of older people that comment on there, and you can see it. You know, they're excited to get 5% on their investments finally. You know, they're sitting on $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000, and suddenly they have thousands of dollars more per year to spend than they had before, and they're spending it. They're going out and spending this money, you know. And so we have this increase and consumer spending from the people that are spending the interest income. And then we're talking substantial amounts of money, you know, and this has the effect of creating demand. Of course, there are other people that borrow that now pay more in interest, and so they might start spending a little less. So these are the two effects, and the effect of spending more money because of making more money due to higher interest rates is smaller. It's a lot smaller than the effect of spending less because people got laid off, or because they're having to pay more for the mortgages, et cetera. So we haven't seen that part happen yet, but that's the idea of raising interest rates, is to cause demand to go down. What we have seen is the part that where people earn more money, they spend more money. Yeah. So consumer demand has been very strong in the United States, in part because of these high interest rates. Now, in Canada, your formula for the inflation indices includes the mortgage interest rates. In the United States, we don't do that. It's all based on rent factors. So the mortgage interest rates don't directly impact our inflation figures. But, you know, if you have high home prices, you tend to have higher rent sometimes. And so you get that situation. But in the United States, we do not count mortgage interest rates in our CPI figures. In Canada, you do. So that is one of the reasons why CPI figures went up in Canada, because your mortgage interest rates went up. And of course now that has stopped, so that's no longer a pressure. Now we've got other factors. In the last inflation reading in Canada, you know, there's all kinds of other stuff that's going back up. So that inflation fight is far from over. But in both cases, you know, you have the policy move by central bank has more than one effect. And there's usually one dominant effect, and that's what they're going after, but they're side effects, and they may counteract the dominant effect to some extent.
How is the U.S. consumer doing amid these higher interest rates?
Yeah, so, you know, there's the same. There's two groups out there. You know, they're the people that really benefit from these higher interest rates, the people that that have savings and their own treasury securities and that have money market funds, you know, and so they're making more money and they're spending this money and they're doing well. And then, you know, we have the 30-year fixed rate mortgages in the United States and they're fixed for 30 years and your payment doesn't change for 30 years. You know? And these people refinance and locked in their low interest rates when those interest rates were very, very low, so a couple of years ago, and that won't change. So they're not impacted by the higher interest rates. The new home buyers are impacted by them, so that's a, you know, relatively small number of people that buy homes every year. And then the people that finance the car purchases, they're impacted by that quite a bit. You know, car prices have gone up a lot, and now they're having much higher interest rates to finance those cars. So that's putting pressure on vehicle sales. In terms of credit cards, you know, there are not that many people in the United States that borrow on their credit cards. There's a relatively small number, and interest rates are already usurious here. You know, they're 20, 30%. They've been 30% before the Fed. When interest rates were 0%, the central bank policy rates were 0%. You know, credit card rates, many of them were over 30%, and it's been that way. So raising that by a little bit won't make a lot of difference. And when people try to not use their credit cards because it's a borrowing method, you know, they're using them to pay for things, and they get the 2% cash back, and they're paying them off every month, you know, because you get all this money back, and you're encouraged to do it, and it's an electronic way of paying. It's convenient. And so we have a lot of that, and it shows up in the credit card balances, but they're not interest-bearing. You know, they don't ever pay any interest on those. So, you know, we have that part, but then there's some part of the people that borrow on their credit card, and that's getting a little more expensive. But it's really not a huge amount. So in terms of the biggest impact, I think it's on car sales and the automakers' captive finance companies. So Ford Credit, for example, you know, they're buying down the finance rate, so they're offering incentives on finance rates, so they have maybe 3.99% financing, or some of them have 2.9% financing, and as an incentive to sell cars and some of the slowly moving vehicles. So that counteracts some of the higher market rates. But overall, you know, you have these higher interest rates that are putting a little bit of pressure on consumers on one side and giving them more cash to spend on the other side. And at the same time, you know, employment is really strong and pay has gone up at rates we haven't seen in 40 years. People who want to work are working. You know, people who get laid off can find jobs very quickly. In general, yeah, so this is a labor market that is very, very tight and with still very strong wage increases across the board, and especially at the lower end. There's still labor shortages in some of the lower paid sectors, big sectors such as lodging and the whole hospitality sector, lodging and restaurants, you know, they still have problems. There's teacher shortage and these shortages cause wages to increase because, you know, employers have to offer more pay to hire people. And so, you know, consumers are feeling pretty good and they hate inflation, but they're making more money now and they've gotten used to inflation and they're spending money. And retail sales came out pretty strong. Walmart just reported pretty strong sales. It reported online sales were up 28%. You know, people buying this stuff online, they're not necessarily going to the store anymore. They're buying this stuff online and e-commerce sales are strong. You know, they're really going up. And Walmart confirmed that. We've seen it in overall data. So, I mean, the consumer is not blasting through this with flying colors. So that slowed down a little bit. But, you know, consumer spending is growing. In the first quarter, we had rock-solid consumer spending growth adjusted for inflation. And, you know, there's some slowdown in, on some other parts companies and so forth. But in terms of the consumer, you know, it's just amazing. Of course, they're sitting on all this cash still and that they had from refinancing their homes, doing cash out refis and you know, they got stimulus monies and they're making more money on their jobs and they're still sitting on some of these other pandemic monies and this money is getting spent the consumer doesn't seem to want any kind of landing soft or otherwise. They just want to enjoy their lives, and traveling is huge. I mean, I live in San Francisco travel center. You know, I mean, it's just packed with tourists. And, now from all over the place. And I went to the airport to pick up my wife the other day, and it was bedlam at the airport, at the arrivals lanes, you know. And people are doing stuff. They're spending money. A lot of it gets spent on services. Restaurants are full. So, it you know, so far I don't see any particular slowdown in consumer spending. It just, the rate hikes just haven't really, you know, pulled the rug out from under our consumers. You know, they just, right now, they're out there spending.
How are electric vehicles impacting energy markets?
Yes, I've been watching that. At first, EV sales were really just a minor thing, you know, and you couldn't really see it in the energy markets at all. And now in 2022, you know, EV sales jumped. And in California already in the first quarter of 2023, we're now at 20% of all new vehicles sold are battery electric vehicles. And that's a lot. You know, so that's starting to show up. And it's starting to show up in two ways. And one, on gasoline consumption. And so that has gone down nationwide in the United States last year, even though miles driven has gone up. And that's an interesting thing. So people drive more, they commute more, you know, they spend more, lots of companies have called their workers back to work, to the office, you know, at least several days a week from 0 days a week. You know, now they have to go back to 3 or 4 days a week. And so they're driving to work. So we have more commuting driving, and we see that. Yeah, so miles driven are up. And at the same time, gasoline consumption last year was down. And that, you know, yeah, some of it is increased fuel efficiency by new vehicles that are being purchased, and that's been a trend for two decades, but it was down more than that. So now we see the impact of EVs for the first time. And at the same time, we had an increase in electricity consumption. And, you know, in the United States, electricity consumption nationally had plateaued for 15 years because of higher efficiency in light bulbs and appliances and industrial equipment and so forth. And we shipped some of the heavy manufacturing offshore. So our electricity consumption in the United States didn't go anywhere since about 2007. It just kind of stayed flat. It wobbled up and down. You know, we had the Great Recession, went down a little bit, then it recovered a little bit, but it just didn't go back to a growth pattern. It just kind of stayed flat. And in 2022 was the first year we broke out of that range. And not because the economy was that hot. I mean, it was a normal economy. It didn't grow all that much, you know, and it was kind of, you know, weakly growing. It was just a sort of feeble growth. And but because gasoline consumption dropped, and electricity consumption increased because EVs are now a more significant portion of the national fleet driving around. And, I mean, they've been waiting for that year to show up. And so we finally saw it, and it's going to happen further. And oil companies know this. You know, they have stopped building refineries. You know, they have change the refinery output toward exports. And we do that big time in California. We've got dropping gasoline consumption in California, but the refineries here are massively exporting gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel to Latin America, to Mexico, and others. Yeah, these refineries are importing crude oil, and they're exporting the refined products. And they're doing this all along the Gulf Coast. And that's a big thing now. So part of the exports in the United States, a big part is these kinds of petroleum products, and that refineries are now making for export because there's not enough demand locally for it. And so that the oil companies have known this for years. And they've known it. They've seen it coming with increased fuel efficiency of vehicles, and that started two decades ago to make a dent into into gasoline consumption. And now they're seeing with EVs, you know, they're not investing in the gasoline sales infrastructure anymore. A lot of gas stations have disappeared. The older ones, you know, they shut them down and dig a big hole in the ground to remove the contaminated soil and build something else on it. And we've seen that. We've seen that big time in San Francisco. You know, we've got EV charging stations everywhere, in every corner, but it's hard to find a gas station these days. I mean, there are in some corridors, there's still some left, but the neighborhood gas stations have disappeared. And So this is a trend that will continue to play out. We will have fuel consumption shift from gasoline over to electricity. And so there will be more natural gas. The coal consumption has been going down for two decades, so that's not going to change. That's going to keep going down. But natural gas consumption will go up by power producers. And then, of course, renewables are doing really well. They're growing in leaps and bounds. And so that shift is pretty significant. It's now visible. And it's also interesting because EVs use a lot less energy than an internal combustion engine vehicle. They waste a lot less energy in a gasoline-powered vehicle, somewhere between 60% of the energy the gasoline it uses becomes waste energy, waste heat, you know, just when you're cruising on the highway. But when you're idling, 100% of the gasoline you're burning is waste heat. So these are really incredibly inefficient devices, these internal combustion engines, and an electric motor is so much more efficient. So the energy consumption overall by an EV is a fraction of that of an ICE vehicle. And so you will see energy consumption overall go down a little bit, but it will shift from gasoline over to whatever power producers, power generators are using for their fuel. And a lot of it will be covered by renewables.
Is it tougher to get bank loans to buy vehicles?
Well, it's more expensive. That's for sure, a lot more expensive. I mean, the rates have kind of doubled, essentially, you know, for vehicle purchases. Now, lending standards have not really gone up for people with good credit. But subprime-rated customers are facing a harder time. We've had, of course, they're kind of vulnerable, you know, because they when they walk into a dealership, and especially a specialized dealership that's catering to subprime, you know, they're getting ripped off. They're paying more for the vehicle than anybody else, and they're financing at much higher rates, and so they're much more likely to default, and so those default rates are always high, and they've crept up recently. And we've had two specialized dealer lenders, you know, so these are companies with about 40 dealerships in the country, and they were specialized for subprime customers. And yeah, they ripped them off, and they sold them the average vehicle like for $5,000 more than normal, and then they charged them instead of 6% or 5%, you know, they charged them, you know, 12% or whatever, 15% on the loans, and two of those chains collapsed, and not necessarily because their customers got into serious trouble. I mean, they're always in trouble. I mean, when somebody overpays by $5,000 for a vehicle and then has to pay 20% interest on it, you know, they are almost guaranteed to default on that loan pretty soon because that payment is just outrageous, you know. And they either default or they refinance through a credit union or something. And those are really the two options. And and so they've done this very aggressively, these two chains, and they collapsed. And that's gone away. So these customers that used to buy there, they don't buy there anymore. And so it's, for them, it's going to be a little tougher to get financing. A lot of other dealerships don't really specialize in subprime financing. I mean, they treat them like other customers. They might get same price vehicle and charge a little bit more interest, you know. And if they can get a lender to approve the loan, they'll be fine. And lenders are looking more carefully at subprime rated customers, meaning they're requiring income verification on those kind of normal things. And the specialized lenders are pretty loose with some of these things, but when you walk to a regular dealership, you know, going to a regular finance company, they will be a little bit more careful in how they check out these customers. And so on that end, it has gotten a little tighter.
Do you expect to see deep discounts on vehicles later this year?
Well, we're already seeing them. You know, they're here. They're here in vehicles that are piling up on dealer lots. You know, so there's some models that have a lot off. Pickup trucks, you know, and suddenly they were out of pickup trucks a couple of years ago. Now they've got pickup trucks and a lot of them, and they're not selling as much. You know, the Ram dealers are very well stocked, overstocked with pickups. Ford dealers have lots of pickups, you know. But if you go to a Toyota store and try to buy a Camry, you won't find a lot. So So you'll have all kinds of incentives. So Ford is starting to do a program buying down or offering an incentivized finance rate on pickup trucks, and there are incentives on vehicles. So they're already here. And when dealers are overstocked, they themselves may add incentives. So right now, I think it is very important when customers go out there that they shop around, that they negotiate, that they inform themselves on the internet, you know, what other dealers are offering. I mean, it's no longer the time where customers have to pay whatever to buy whatever is left on the lot. You know, there's one pickup truck left on the lot and then three people fighting over it. It's not that situation anymore. You know, people have to go back to the old habits of trying to work a deal and be careful what they pay for these vehicles and watch the financing rates, make sure that they're not getting ripped off on the interest rate. And, you know, right now is if you're, you know, in the market for a truck, you know, there's zero reason to overpay.
Could housing be in a spring market dead cat bounce?
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit of a bounce in prices. You know, we just got the data out for the United States nationally today. And sales fell again. You know, I mean, it's terrible here. You know, they're down well over 20% from a year ago. A year ago was already bad. And, you know, prices, they went up with the spring selling season. They always go up this time of the year. But they didn't go up as much as they did last year, and they didn't go up as much as they did 2 years ago. So year over year, the price declines fell further, so that, you know, now we're in the hole further than year over year than we were last month. And so this is the third month in a row here that our national median price is in the red year over year. In Canada, it's a similar procedure. I mean, you started earlier, you drop faster and further than our prices did here nationally. And there's a bounce, you know, there's also spring selling season in Canada, so you had a pretty good bounce in your prices there in March and April. And, you know, the bounce will fade as we go through the summer, into the summer, and then, you know, we're back to the normal. And so this is very seasonal. And I don't really know where Canada is going to go, because your mortgage rates are so different. They're so much more dependent on short-term rates. Ours are dependent on long-term rates. Yeah, 6.5% 30-year mortgage rates right now. That's not changing. And, you know, I just don't, you know, the supply is coming up. Sales are going down. Investors are pulling out. We're seeing all the mechanics. I mean, there's a little bit of spring selling going on, but it's not keeping up with last year and the year before last year. So, you know, it doesn't look like to me. I mean, even during our housing bust one here in the United States, our nasty housing bust one that played out from like 2005 through 2012, depending on which part of the country you're in. And even then, home prices rose during these spring months. So, you know, that's just what they do. Even our home prices back then, yeah, they dropped a whole bunch over those 5 years, and in some areas dropped by 50%. Even during the spring selling season, we had price increases. So that's what it looks like to me. You know, it looks like a spring selling season that will prices increase at some kind of normal or below normal rate. And then it's over. The springtime is over, and then it goes back to trend.
If fewer people are working in office towers, what could the future hold for office towers?
Yeah, so, you know, this is a huge problem. And, in San Francisco, we used to have, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had the hottest office market in the United States with the lowest vacancy rates. Vacancy rates in the mid-single digits, 7%. I mean, just historically low. Nobody could get any kind of office. there's just nothing available. And so now we've got the worst vacancy rates in the country, worse even than Houston and Dallas. You know, they got, especially Houston, got hit by the oil bust in 2016, and the office sector went downhill from that point on. And there were over 30% vacancy rates for a while. Now San Francisco is worse than that. So that means one-third of the office space is now on the market for lease. So we had our first sale of an office tower, and since all this started, so the first one in over 2 years, and it was sold by a bank, so it didn't have a mortgage on it, and so it didn't have lenders to worry about. It was sold by a bank, its former headquarter buildings off that bank, and the bank will lease part of it back, will stay in part of the office tower, so it was a sale lease back, and the price was dropped 75% from the original asking price in 2020. 75%, and then a buyer emerged. So at that deal. So, yeah, that's kind of where we are. You can sell office buildings to another buyer if you drop the pre-pandemic price by 75%. That's kind of where we are. When they go through foreclosure, office towers can be essentially worthless. A huge office tower, the AT&T Center in St. Louis was sold in foreclosure the other day. And it didn't even bring enough money to pay for the expenses and fees of the foreclosure proceedings, and the lenders essentially got nothing. And for them, it was 100% loss. Yeah, I mean, foreclosure sales are brutal. We had some office towers in Houston sell at a lot for the lenders. I mean, there's also losses for equity holders. You know, the owners had lost their shirts on these. So now these are just lenders. You know, they have... they only have part of the value of the tower, and you know they lost 80%, 87% on those towers in Houston. So that's what we're talking about here. You know, these older office towers really aren't worth much, and many of them will have to be torn down if they can't be converted into residential, and most of them will not be able to. You just can't convert a 1980s office tower into residential. It's too expensive. It's cheaper to just tear it down and start from scratch, and so developers will buy those towers for the land value or less than the land value and build something on it. And, you know, it's brutal for landlords. It's brutal for lenders. But ultimately, it'd be great for cities way down the road, you know, because your downtowns now are empty at night, you know, the office towers after office towers. And if you convert some of those or many of those into residential or tear them down and build residential towers, you'll have mixed-use downtowns, and they'll be livelier, they'll be better places to be, you know, and people can live there closer to work. And there's already some residential towers in or near financial districts, for example, in San Francisco and in Manhattan, of course, and in other places. So this is a long term. I think this is a good move, but it's just very brutal for investors in office towers and for lenders to office towers. So these lenders, that so far they haven't been banks. You know, the deals that we had these big problems with, the lenders weren't banks. The lenders were investors, so that had bought these commercial mortgage-backed securities, and there were private equity firms that had provided the mortgage, and there were mortgage REITs, and so these big losses really haven't hit the banks yet, even though that's going to eventually happen. But it seems like the banks sold most of those high-risk office tower loans a while back and either securitized them or sold them to mortgage REITs or whoever, you know, got the insurance companies, you know, got rid of them, and so far that's been spared. But this is where the pain is. So it'll be landlords, and it'll be investors, and it'll be lenders. But I think for the future of these downtowns, and for the economy too, you know, tearing down an office tower and building a new residential tower, you know, that's good for the economy. That's a lot of work, and it's a lot of spending, and it's a lot of investment, and, you know, there's a lot of progress with that. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, this really needs to happen. I think it will improve our big cities, and overall, I think it will work for the economy. But if you invest in office towers or lend it to office towers, I think it's going to be tough.
Could mortgage-backed securities cause the housing market to collapse?
Yeah, so in terms of the residential mortgage-backed securities in the United States, you know, most of them, even in Canada, you know, most of them are guaranteed by the government. Banks no longer are on the hook for the credit losses for most of them. And there's some private label mortgage-backed securities that are not guaranteed by the government. And so those may be a problem. But the mechanism is really the other way around. Yeah, so homeowners don't default on the mortgages when home prices rise. You know, they just, if they can't make the mortgage payment, if they get laid off, they sell the home and they pay off the mortgage with the proceeds from the sales, and they have a little cash left over and they can go rent and buy a new car and go on. You know. The problem arises when home prices fall. And so now they have fallen, and but they haven't fallen a lot. So only the people that bought within the last year or so might face a loss if they can't make the mortgage payment anymore and they have to sell the home. And then they're having trouble actually selling the home because they won't get enough money to pay off the mortgage. And so, but it's still not a big problem because there's not many people who bought a home in the last year who would be impacted by that. So, you know, I don't envision this to be an issue right now. But if home prices drop another 20 or 30% from here, then there'll be more people underwater. And so if they lose their job and have to sell their home, they won't be able to get enough for the home to pay off the mortgage. And so there'll be some kind of short sale involved or a default, you know, and they just let the lender have the home. And so then the lenders will have to deal with the losses. And that will eventually wash through to mortgage-backed securities, and most of them are guaranteed by the government, so the taxpayer will end up with a bill for those. And then if they're not guaranteed by the government, investors, so private investors, pension funds, bond funds, et cetera, will carry those losses. And banks are really only on the margin involved with residential mortgages. They still have some, but it's not huge, and generally high quality stuff that they retain. So, you know, I don't think the mortgage-backed securities will cause the housing market to crash. It'll be the other way around. If the housing market crashes, it will cause mortgage-backed securities to get in trouble, which means taxpayers will get in trouble and pay for most of it. And then there'll be some investors that will lose their shirts on their investments in mortgage-backed securities. But that's the direction it will go. You know, if so, we need to have a big decline in home prices before investors and lenders are looking at trouble there.
Wolf, before we go, could you tell us a little bit about Wolf Street?
WolfStreet.com. It's free. There's no paywall. You don't have to sign up for anything. It's all about business, finance, and money, and no politics. We have a largely well-behaved comment section that I participate in actively. So lots of good stuff going on, WolfStreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Straith, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.